Hello, this is Yaro Starek, and welcome to Vested Capital, Episode 1. This is the first episode of my new rebranded show featuring a guest. His name is Mark Asquith. He is the founder of Captivate.fm and Rebel Base Media. We're going to talk about Mark's history, how he started a whole bunch of different businesses, including an agency, a podcast, web design company, and his most current and the business that I really got involved with called Captivate.fm, a hosting and statistics platform for podcasters. I am in the process of experimenting with different new tools for this brand new version of my podcast. If you are interested, of course, you can hear the story behind why I changed the name of my show. It used to be called The Yaro Podcast, and before that, The Entrepreneur's Journey Podcast, going back 15 years. You can still listen to what I believe are some of the best episodes from those shows in the feed of the show you're listening to now. So I popped 50 plus episodes that I thought were the most relevant for this new topic of vested capital going forward. Some great guests. And if you go back to the previous episode, just before this one, episode 0 of Vested Capital, you will hear my background story around how I've built capital, what kind of businesses I've started, how I've invested, and so on. I gave you a bit of a primer as we dive into this new topic with guests, beginning today with Mark. So you're going to learn about Mark and how he started both his agencies, his web design, podcast design site, how he marketed them, and also how he's built teams, grown his company, and chosen what to do. He's one of those multifaceted entrepreneurs who likes to do different things. So if you're like that and you also want to do different things, you might gain a little bit of insight from what Mark has done with his own career. And of course, if you're in the podcasting space at all, this will be interesting to you as well. So I'll press play on that episode in just a second. First of all, I want to mention, I'm not going to really call it a sponsor because I don't really feel like that's the appropriate label for this, but it is my company. It's called InboxDone.com. I'm going to say that the Vested Capital Show is brought to you by InboxDone, at least for this episode. InboxDone is a service where we take over managing your email for you. So if you're drowning in email, perhaps you're drowning in support desk tickets, customer support tickets, you need someone to either step in and take over up to 80, 90, even 100% of your email. And when I say that, I mean replying to your messages, not just organizing them, but actually replying to them. Then we can help. It's called InboxDone.com. I co-founded the company a number of years ago, and I'd love to help you if you need some help with email. Okay, that's it for my little spiel about my company. And here is the episode today with Mark Asquith. Hey, Mark. So thanks for joining me. We were just talking behind the scenes there about your podcast hosting company. I'm actually using Riverside, which is a podcast streaming platform, a new one. You're my first guest on this platform, but I'd love to learn so much about you, Mark. And I'm bringing you on sort of as the first guest because I'll be honest, Captivate, your hosting distribution service for podcasts. I was making this choice about what platforms to use, including Riverside. You came up. You're a friend of a few mutual friends, David Bain, Chris Tucker. And yeah, I just thought it'd be great to get you on the show, A, to talk a little bit about the tech behind podcasting, but B, you as a founder of obviously a tech podcasting company and just everything in your background. So maybe you could, first of all, give me a summary. It might be a long summary of what is everything you're involved with right now.
Good question. So, well, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure. I'm delighted to do this. So what I do now is I run a number of different businesses in podcasting, all at various stages in their life cycle. And we'll perhaps get to the original business in podcasting, because that's a quite an interesting story that leads to Captivate and a few others. But just to very quickly summarize it, Kieran and I, my co-founder, we're collectively known as Rebel Base Media. I can see on the video version of this that you've got an AT-AT there behind you. We are also Star Wars geeks. You see, you're an ATAT guy. I like that. You see, I always argue with my Star Wars podcast co-host.
I do feel a bit like a traitor because I'm actually a Trekkie before I'm a Star Wars person. I happen to have this on the wall. So, but I like
It's like that. Smooth. And it's the company that we run is kind of is named after the rebel base on Yavin and so on. So we're kind of geeks at heart. Kieran and I are geeks at heart, and we build businesses. You know, we use our collective to really kind of test ideas out, and then when we decide that we enjoy one or we get some traction in one, we spin that out into a specific business, recruit the team in, let them help us to scale it and really build business by business. And we've done that a few times in podcasting. So what I do now is I run Captivate.fm, which is the hosting platform that we talked about. So that's a world-class hosting analytics and distribution platform for podcasts. I run the original business podcast websites, which is sort of like a WP Curve style platform or service just for podcasters. We've got an education membership that we're just transitioning into something to do with Captivate. And we also run an interaction tech startup, which is a pure sort of punt of a startup, as most startups are, which is purely around audience engagement and interaction in podcasting. And I podcast as well about Star Wars and podcast about podcasting and speak at events and write in places and so on. So that's what I do. And I'm fully in the podcasting industry. That's my daily job. So yeah, it's what I do every day, man.
Okay. Is it fair to say, though, Captivate is the big one in that sort of collection of companies?
Yeah, I think so. Captivate is certainly the one that people know us the most for, and that people most people use. It's a hosting platform, and I think every podcast needs a hosting platform, of course. So it's certainly the one that's the necessity in the podcasting stack. The other ones are sort of nice to have for people. So people do know us for Captivate, even though that's one of the youngest businesses. It's the one where we help the most podcasters. And it's one where we make the most noise right now because we're just always releasing features. So inevitably, there's more noise that comes with that. So yeah, Captivate's certainly the one that people recognize for now.
I was actually curious with Captivate I'd call it a SaaS, I believe. I mean, it's definitely a software platform that you pay a subscription for. I spent like a few days over the last week getting familiar with everything. You know, it's got analytics on your downloads. Obviously, it's got all the settings to control each individual episode that you upload. Lots of bells and whistles around the hosting and distribution of your show just to control the variables and make it easier to share. I love the fact that it creates a sort of a website, like a version 1.0 of a podcast website that you could totally run with as your main website for your podcast. So that's all, like, it sounds like a lot of things going on. And I can imagine as a entrepreneur myself who has attempted several times to build software-based companies, the engineering that goes on behind these companies can be a challenge, to say the least. So is there, like, who is your team with Captivate, and how hard has it been to grow this type of software company versus, say, a media company like a podcast, which, let's face it, as a podcaster, it's a lot easier. You record a file, you upload it, and away you go. There's no programming and so on.
Yeah, it's a deep kind of approach to this as well, Yarrow. So Kieran and I have got a very specific model. Like we're very fortunate. You know, we'll probably get to the background of things in a little while, but you'll see sort of when we get to that my background affords me the chance to be able to do certain levels of coding, certainly front-end coding. Got a decent eye for design. And I'm really kind of, ahead in product and brand strategy, whereas Kieran is a through and through programmer. So when you put those two heads together, that's why we're able to create things like Rebel Base Media, where we can take a product and sort of prototype it, get it to version one. So Captivate, as you see it today, was, outside of some of the more later additions to the team, it was pretty much built by Kieran and I over the course of 2019, really the early stage of 2019, from January 2019 to the launch in August. We got our first user in April, which was Ian Anderson Gray, and then launched into beta in August. And that was he and I. we built the thing up. Wow. And we spent countless nights sat around a table saying, do you know what, let's scrap this and move to something else, and let's scrap how this create episode page looks and just start from scratch. And we literally just did that all ourselves. And it's only now that we've got the team, and our model is to kind of go from zero to one and then hire the team in, firstly bolstered by support and then some engineers, and then more recently our head of design and our digital marketing manager. And when we look at what's coming next for Captivate, the version 2, which is going to be launching very, very soon, actually. It's going to be launching in June 2021. And that is such a platform. Like, it has everything that Captivate holds true and dear, which is the ease of use and everything that you'd expect from the brand. But it's like a real platform, whereas when I log into Captivate now, it's just me thinking, This is the thing that Kieran and I built that Wednesday night. You know, we built the single promo link. We just built it on a Wednesday night with a curry. And it was like this weird thing. So the founding team were really the engineers and the builders and the marketers. Now, we were, you know, not taking that lightly and not saying that flippantly. We were very fortunate to have had what I call sort of a bridging business in podcasting. So we had our original WordPress business in podcasting, which we still run to this day. It's a great business and a fantastic service. But we'd sort of been afforded the chance to have a few years in the industry where we'd speak at events, where we would, you know, we'd travel and would be around speaking at Podcast Movement and Podfest, producing our episodes, speaking to podcasters. So kind of by proxy, we'd done so much user research. So there is sort of... there's a potential for it to sound a little bit flippant when I say, well, it was just Kieran and I on a nighttime building it. The pre-work that we'd done by proxy of the other business is not to be underestimated. That was the thing that we really got lucky with, because we were just able to gather that intel very, very early on. But yeah, that's how we got there. And we, you know, from a founder's perspective, we actually set three very specific things up when we built the business. And I think this is interesting from a business dev perspective. We said that the three things that we were going to use as sort of benchmarks for scaling were, we weren't going to introduce things like annual plans until we'd hit a certain MRR threshold so that we could bolster the bottom line and not require funding. The second thing that we did was, we said that we will always be in support. You know, we will be there in support. That will be our number one priority. And then the third thing, when we do eventually begin to hire, which we'd started doing late 2019, the first thing that we would hire would be support, and we'd really button up that experience part of it. So yeah, that's a bit of the background on how we got from that kind of nothingness to a launch. It was some late nights, man, and there were some arguments, you know?
I can imagine. I'm glad to hear about the focus on support. As you know, I run Inbox Done, which is all about, you know, doing your email and your customer support. And I think that is one of the first things you need to handle. Except with a software company, you have to start with something software related. There's no point if you have nothing to support. So let's go back in time, because I can really feel in your case, Mark, there's a lot of connecting the dots between projects here. There's a real sense of one leading to the other. Obviously, you're known as the British podcast guy. So born and raised somewhere on the island. Is that correct?
It is. Yeah. Do so much travel, but we're right here now. We just moved actually more into the middle of England. And I should add that I got that sort of moniker from the early days of Podcast Movement, when I used to travel out. I'd like be the only English guy there, and people could never remember my name. They used to confuse it with Mark or Matt or something else. And it was described to me that people would always just say, well, which one's he? It's that British podcast guy. It's that British guy. Oh, well, that domain's available, so we'll have that.
I've been the guy with the long hair. I've been the Australian with the Canadian accent. It's easier for us to just have one thing that people know us by, and that's it. So we should be thankful.
It really is.
British podcast guy. Everyone remembers you.
Exactly. I am grateful for that. And it's that sort of testament, that user research that I mentioned earlier, that sort of testament to you know, some of the friendships that I built very, very early on in podcasting. Podcasting's still a very small ecosystem, despite being a multi-billion dollar industry now. You know, when I got into it in 2012, 2013, it was, you know, there was 180,000 podcasts versus 2.1 million that there is today. And that sort of connects to something that you mentioned as well, Yarrow, which is that connecting of the dots, you know, the past life connecting to podcasting and to where we are now. It was around that time that transition started to happen. So my old life was an agency, and you know, we built this small agency in Barnsley in England, where we were a very focused agency. We acquired a printing company and a photography company, and you know, we were working on the standard kind of website builds, you know, the 5, 10, 15 grand website builds, and then started to build software for education and do branding work for some of the big brands in the world, and ended up doing covers for like New York Times and all this. So we sort of scaled this agency.
What year was this?
But then, what's that, sorry?
What year did you start that?
So we started that in about 2008. Okay. And that time period where we'd scaled it was around, 2013, 2014, which sort of segued with the podcasting. There was that kind of that kind of dovetail between the podcasting world.
My show, my first version of my show was 205. So I, and like, I don't know how many podcasts existed in 2005, not many. I just love to know the really, really early days. So you, in 2008 in Barnsley, you're starting an agency. Was there any, like prior to that, any kind of successful business, or were you, I don't know how old you are, Mark. I don't know if you were a young lad, you know, going to university before that or not, but I don't know, what was the growing up like?
Yeah, I wish I was young. I wear the hat so I can hide the gray. I was in about 2008. I was 26 years old. And the story is a little bit bizarre, actually. I dropped out of college. So I left school, dropped out of college. I didn't really have much money as a kid, so money was a real big defining thing for me. And when I got to college, I was at music college. And if anyone's watching the video of this, you'll see the musical stuff behind me. I was fortunate that just came fairly naturally. So college didn't move quick enough. That's the other thing that my brain does. It moves really quick, not always to the benefit of what I'm doing, but it does. So kind of this speed of thinking and this ideation that I was doing and this lack of money, I dropped out of college. Blagged my way into a job at like age 18.
Doing what?
I was a pensions administrator, mate. I remember it was dull. exactly. It was like I was the talk of the town administering those pensions. And I was fighting them off. And to top it off, the interview that I turned up at for this job, I'd bought a tie. It's awful. I bought this silver tie, mate, with a dragon on it. Like, you know, one of those 1999, year 2000 dragon things. Mm-hmm. And we used to wear that in town as well. So we'd go out drinking in the same clothes. Oh, man, it was awful. And I was like 18 at the time. Did 4 years of that, realized that I was just bored of it. I wasn't very good at it. But that sort of, some of the stuff that I did there introduced me into coding, which we'll perhaps get to in a bit. But I had these couple of jobs. And I remember just getting, if your boredom threshold is at like 100% at age 19, that's where I was when I got this job. 4 years later, 22, 23 years old, I'd switched the job once. I moved a couple hundred miles away and came back. So I switched jobs when I did that. 3 or 4 years later, same kind of job, boredom threshold down to about 10%. I hated it. There were people telling me to do things that I didn't understand. And I don't understand why I had to wear a tie. Why couldn't I have highlights in my hair in the year 2002 when, you know, I wasn't allowed to do it because it was company policy. It was stupid. I got this other job in another city, which is about 20 minutes away from where I lived. And I remember trading this job, my old job, for a new job and getting a $2,000 pay rise. And the $2,000 pay rise was like the thing that I chased. So I get to this other job and it's day one. I walk through the door, same kind of get up, you know, bad sort of bad suit. You know, it was awful, nothing fit. And walked in and it was like I'd put my pen down at the old job and picked it back up at the new one. Nothing was different. And I left. I was there about an hour and I got up and left. And I just said to the manager, Graham, I just said, look, man, I've been here 2 hours. It's not causing me any problems, but this is the last time I'm doing anything like this. And just left. I didn't have any plan. I didn't have anything. I just walked out and my mum went crazy, mate. My dad didn't, but my mum did. She went nuts. What happened after that was really interesting. So I was on about 20 grand at that point, which, you know, for a 22-year-old in the year 2001, 2002, 2003 was all right. You know, it was all right. I could pay what I needed to pay. Did a little bit of work with my dad. He's an electrician. So he got me doing a little bit of fetching and carrying for, I don't know, 5-6 weeks. And I got a job interview for a freelance trainer because I once did some training at my old job. So I put on my resume, on my CV, I put on that I could do training. So I looked out into getting this interview and got the job. Now, I didn't know this, but it turns out this job was a day rate job. So almost overnight, at age 22, 23, I went from earning 20 grand a year to almost 200 grand a year.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it was insane, mate. I was like,
what's the day rate?
Yeah. So a day rate is where I would turn up and I would be contracted for a period of time to work with people like the Ministry of Defence or the National Health Service. And I was contracted for, say, 3 months at a time, and they would pay me X amount per day. You know, £300-£500 per day, which at that time is insane. It's still amazing money now.
And what were you doing exactly at these different places? Just teaching, training?
I was just learning things. I was learning business development or project management, and then I was training other people on the things that I'd learned. So I was, you know, I would just go in and acquire some skills. The best one that I did was working for the Ministry of Defence. So imagine this. 22, 23 years old, ready to put a bill in for £400-£500 for the one day's work. And on my first day, turned up at an airstrip for the Ministry of Defence, for the Army, in a suit at 23 years old, looking an idiot. This old major, he was called Dave. He was a fantastic guy. And he just, what are you dressed as? And I was like, yeah, all right, you got me. I said, well, you know, what's the plan? I'm here to train you on this new recruitment platform and some business change around it. Like, what's the plan? And he pointed to a zip wire. He said, get up there, go down the zip wire, crawl under that cargo net, get back in your car and go home. And I was like, he's having a laugh. This guy's joking. He wasn't, right? He wasn't. He got me to go down the zip wire. He got me covered. And he threw the mud and the dirt. After I'd finished it, he was really bizarre. He just came up, put his arm around me and just said, whatever you do, come back tomorrow. Don't dress like that. Dress in whatever you want, but do a damn good job for me. I'll see you tomorrow. I was like, oh, all right. And that was day one on the job. So going from corporate to that, it sort of opened my eyes. You know, actually, you can earn decent money. You can do a great job for people. And this guy respected me after 1 hour more than my old bosses had done for years because I didn't jump to their tune. And that was an eye-opener, man.
Just, I'm curious, what was the actual job though after you did the, it's completely off topic here, Mark, but like you did a zip line, you came back the next day. How do you get, because you don't get paid £500 a day to ride a zip line. That doesn't make sense as a job. Like, what were you actually teaching people?
I taught them just how to use their own recruitment systems. That was it. So I'd gone in the week before and learned. So I went like down south to the south coast, learned how to use this platform. And then day one was like, right, go back to your territory in Yorkshire, train your local army on how to use this software. And that day one was his way of basically breaking down the corporate levels in me and kind of embedding me into his world, because I needed, in order to be able to train a grizzly old sergeant and an old major that had left the army and was now recruiting new recruits, there was no way they were going to respect me turning up in my suit and telling them how to do the job. So we kind of broke that down and built it back up with that 1 hour of work. And he still signed off the invoice as well. I still got paid £500 for that one day, which is fascinating.
That's a good first day. Okay. So you're making £200,000 a day. A year in, sounds like before you're even 25. That's baller money for anyone that age. You would be living large. Why would you even need to do anything else? You should have just done that for the next few years, then have $1 million in your bank account before you're 30, right?
I know, right? That's not the way that I worked though. So what I realized when I was doing that job was that, a lot of the challenges that I had with money weren't actually about money. You know, that chasing the money wasn't the thing that I was chasing. I was chasing the control to be able to do what I wanted to do. So I remember one day, there was no need for me to be on site. So I was working for the National Health Service at this time, and I was working on a site that was about 4 hours' journey from home. And the person who was running the contract, I said, look, I have no reason to be on site today. What I'm going to do is, instead of doing the 8 hours round trip or whatever it was, or coming and staying away from family or whatever, I'm going to work on these training materials so that I can deliver the course tomorrow. Or I can, you know, whatever it was, I can do that better for you tomorrow. And I had some new stuff to write up. And she said, no, you know, we're paying you. We want you on site. I said, but you've got nothing for me. This is stupid. Like, why would I need to do that? And in the exact opposite kind of approach to the old major. She said, if you don't turn up on site and do the small menial thing that I will make sure I find for you, then I will not sign the invoice. Well, that was the last they saw of me. You know, they didn't see me again because it was ridiculous. And I just said, well, if that's how you run your business, then this is not for me. And that was the last time that I earned the $200,000 a year or the £200,000 a year by billing someone else. So I left.
Did you get fired or like?
No,
no.
I just told them I was leaving.
Okay, so you didn't think this is only one bad case. I could do the next one. You thought, nah, I'm out because I hate not being in control.
Yep. Okay. And it was. And bear in mind, this is 23-year-old me. Okay. Like 39-year-old me would be like, maybe this person's had a bad day. 23-year-old me was like, this. Screw this. So
what did mom say when you did that?
I didn't tell her. Okay, I learned my lesson. Learned my lesson. There is one hidden part of that, though, which was alongside all of this. So while I was earning the 200 grand and whatever it was, I had built up a little bit of a buffer. Not much, but I'd built up enough that I didn't really need to work for a few months. So I learned how to code. And when that buffer started to drop, started to dwindle, started topping it up by selling websites to people.
Okay, when you say learn how to code, before you continue that story, because I also started building websites at about the same age, 23, 24, and I bought myself a textbook, Teach Yourself HTML in 24 Hours. And that's how I learned very basic website building skills. Now, I don't call myself a coder because I would not be able to build a Captivate.fm like you guys have built today. I can still only do a few HTML tags, nothing to do with like, you know, PHP or C Sharp or all the coding languages nowadays, Ruby on Rails. What did you learn at that point at 23? Was it just website building basics? Because, you know, there must be a connection then to learning a lot more in development skills.
Yeah, so I learned essentially the front end skills of the time, and I've sort of kept up with them throughout that as well, even though I do much less of it. So at the time, it was HTML, CSS 1.0 before 2.0 came out, and believe it or not, it was Flash and ActionScript. Remember when that was prevalent on the web? And then we scaled that. You know, I scaled my own knowledge through to things like JavaScript, jQuery in about 2008, CSS 2.0, 3.0. You know, everything from there. But it was everything front end. You know, I was focused on that. So I'm like you, man. I can't really build too much on the back end. I can't really do too much PHP. I certainly can't do any Node.js. I can't do anything. Even with some of the more modern frameworks like Angular, like I could do it, but man, it would be slow. But it was interesting because those skills, this was a lesson that I know everyone sort of learns eventually. Because I had some of those skills, like I was more of an expert than the person that needed the website building. So they started to hire me to build the websites, and suddenly I had a website business, which was really, really weird. But I didn't know how to build a business. I knew how to code, but I didn't know about, like, I knew how to order business cards and set up my my website. That was badass. I looked fantastic when I turned up at a meeting, but I didn't know how to close the meeting. I didn't know how to invoice. I didn't know how to do contracts. I didn't know any of the business stuff because guess what? I remember I dropped out of college. So I had to learn all that stuff on the fly, and that, you know, that eventually led me to some of my co-founders on the agency where we essentially started freelancing as a web designer or a web builder. And we formed an agency with a couple of friends, which, you know, that's the thing that we scaled. But it was tumultuous at the time. It was scary because, you know, that runway that I'd built up, you know, in hindsight, like you said, probably could have stayed on at the couple of hundred grand a year for a little bit of time and built up a little bit of cash. But it was every day. It was 5 a.m. every day working for people that I didn't get on with. Yeah, it was tough. But then the runway dwindled, you know, the 10, 20, 15, whatever grand that I'd saved up. Because I didn't have these business skills, they all dwindled. You know, that money just frittered away, you know?
So tell us more about the agency. So, you know, agencies building websites, it is the most commoditized business on the internet. And I feel safe saying that's the case even in 2008 when you were, you know, going gung-ho with it. So how big did it get, and what was the key to growth?
We got to about 12 people, which for a small agency was fantastically profitable. So we had good retainers building digital projects out, and we scaled it in such a way that was really sensible. So we, I had two founders, co-founders at the time. So it was a chap called Don and a chap called Mark. He was a photographer and Don was a printer. And they brought their skills. So we became very quickly a full service agency. People came to us and we could do everything for them. We then merged with another local agency to basically acquire some talent, another developer, and a fantastic brand designer called Kai Wilkinson, who I still work with today, branded Captivate. We sort of departmentalized a little bit. So I started to lead up the digital stuff where we'd build software for education companies and we'd build platforms for people. Unbeknownst to me, like in 2012, you know, I was building SaaS for people and before SaaS was a thing. And, you know, Kai was running the creative arm and Don was running the print arm and the offline arm and Mark was running the photography arm. And we scaled that really nicely. You know, Kai was doing the pictures. We won some fantastic local authority contracts, which we're a blessing and also a bit of a curse. You know, that's something that is another story, but you know, we scaled this business, but
just to clarify
what happened.
Sorry, Mark. I know when people say they scaled a business, in my mind, it's like, cause I love talking marketing and traffic, word of mouth, advertisement in the local paper. Where were all these customers coming from?
Well, I'll tell you the basics of that. And then that brings me to the next piece, because this is where it gets interesting. So word of mouth, referrals, a lot of, I want to say sort of local advertising, but it was much more reputation management, a lot of PR, a lot of very basic noise making, because, you know, you're right. Web design was commoditized and everything that we did was commoditized, but back in the day, like, no one was doing decent marketing. It was just all shouty sort of, look, there's an advert for this digital company and it's $297 for a basic website. Like, we didn't do that. We were just very noisy in a way that now would be seen to be very normal. But back then, people were like, what are you telling us that for? So it was very much that. But that's an interesting and insightful question, Yarrow, because I actually started getting a little bit bored.
No.
So I know, right? Can you believe it? It's a good job. No, like, I'd matured a little bit. Otherwise, I'd have probably bailed on the industry. don't do that anymore. But what happened was I started to get into digital and started to think to myself in about 2008, 2009, you know, I'm interested in search. I'm interested in organic. I'm interested in this nascent field of content. Guess who that led me to? One Darren Rouse and one Yarrow Starrett. That led me to you guys. And I was like, I'm going to study what you guys are doing. This is fantastic. This is why it's interesting that this is full circle. And I started studying and learning from you chaps. Like, this is badass. This is brilliant. Like, what an interesting thing to be able to do is to spend time seeing what actually works, and actually taking a data-led approach to things where I'd never done that before. It was just kind of throw it out and see what happens, which led me to develop my own skills, which led me to become a little bit more noisy, which led me to push some of the people internally into things that they were a little uncomfortable with, which then led to me leaving the agency because I wanted to do what I'm doing now. So this is all traceable back to the discovery of online marketing back in, I don't know, 2008, 2009, maybe a touch later.
There's a lot of people who have that kind of story. I think that was like their pivotal learning early years. And today they're something incredible. They've built something amazing, as you have. Well, take us forward. So the agency, I'm assuming, you know, you make a good living. You're not necessarily as like a baller as you were at 23 year olds earning 2000. maybe you were, but it, you know, it's not quite the same when you're working in your own company like that. You can't just say, no, I don't want to do this anymore. Well, you could, but take us forward with the agency growth. Cause it, at some point, if you're getting into content marketing, to me, I just think, well, you just do content marketing for your clients. Doesn't necessarily change your business. It just adds another service to what you're already doing. But you don't run an agency today. You're totally in the world of podcasting. So obviously something happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, content marketing was in its infancy. To hammer that home, I remember going to a talk in about 2009, 2010 with someone who branded themselves locally as a content marketer. And she delivered this wonderful talk about content marketing. right at the end, she opened it up to questions, which was like the nail in the coffin for her. Because the last question she got, I'll never forget it. Me and Kai were sat there and she gets a question, which is, what is content marketing and how can it help my business? And her honest answer in front of everyone that she'd spent so long convincing to buy from her was, I don't really know, you know, I've not figured it out yet. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay. So that, I know, right? So that's the timing of content marketing. So for us to try and sell that, the education was so tough to people. Like, why should you pay us hundreds, thousands of dollars a month to do something that you really probably can't understand? This is when like the Yellow Pages were calling up and saying, you know, for 50 quid a month, we'll get your keywords to the top of Google. And it's, they were so hyper local and hyper specific keywords that I could have done it in 15 minutes, you know, but people were buying that and that's what we were up against. So that was starting to happen. And because those were sort of the skills that I was acquiring, but they were very difficult to sell at that time, now less so. My co-founders and the other directors in the agency were like, well, we just need to sell websites and stuff. And I was like, yeah, that's kind of boring. So the second thing that happened was, actually two things happened. I got into podcasting. So I started podcasting for myself. I did a DC Comics podcast. Anyone looking at any video of this chat, you'll see there's DC Comics and Star Wars stuff in the background. I love that sort of stuff. So I started podcasting about it with Gary, who's now our head of design at Captivate. And I started then thinking, wait a sec, I could probably apply this to this content marketing stuff that I'm sort of getting into. Maybe I'll do a business podcast. And ergo, I did a business podcast. The second thing that happened was at the exact same time, I started looking at recurring revenue models of business. So I started to say to the directors in the business, why don't we build software? Why, we're a design agency. Why don't we build a design management platform that we can use, but then other people can buy from us? Why don't we build a PM system, a project management system for design agencies? Because guess what? Nothing exists that does it. You know, even Basecamp was in the infancy back then. And they weren't interested because they didn't see the value straight away. Mm. And so Kieran and I, one of the developers at the agency, as I'd got into podcasting, I said to the lads in the agency, why don't we take all these things that we do for clients now and we charge a one-off thing for and we find it difficult to pitch on an ongoing basis for WordPress management. I said to Kieran one morning, I've got an idea. Why don't we create this WordPress managed platform? We'll spin it up in our spare time. We'll partner with someone in the podcast because we didn't have any, I wasn't in the podcasting industry. And this is 2012, 2013. We'll partner with someone in the podcasting industry and see if we can sell it, someone that's got an audience. So we did. We partnered with John from EO Fire. We opened it up and people started paying like from day one, you know, in, we actually did an old classic pre-launch on that one, Yara. So we launched it on a webinar. We didn't even have a product, but we had some beta users grandfathered in on a deal, and we promised them that by X date it would be live, and they bought into it, and we hit the deadline, and we nailed it.
What was it called?
And that was the transition. That is still called just podcast websites. There was nothing else like it.
Build your podcast website on WordPress for you.
Yeah, well, it was even more automated than that. So because I can do bits of design and Kieran's a coder and we've got a good design eye. We pre-built a website. We built a system that would auto deploy WordPress, and then we built an entire education system around why and how to customize the design that we're giving you with a drag and drop builder and so on. And we built this entire platform out. So people, what they do, and they can do this to this day, theoretically, they can sign up to the platform. A WordPress website will be auto deployed and they will then get all the education and everything that they need to customize it and the community that goes with it. Now, the one thing that existed on the back end of that, and this was a last minute decision. And I mean, like a mega 11th hour decision. I remember talking to a friend over some beer. I said, would you buy this platform if it didn't include podcast hosting and analytics? He was like, no, I wouldn't. Mm-hmm. I was like, Kieran, on the phone, dude, we got to build basic hosting. This is in 2014. And the seeds of Captivate existed in that hosting. So we've been providing that for years. And then again, there's more to the story where we split them out and built each business separately. But that's where it started. And that was the transition from agency to podcasting.
So did you completely leave the agency, and were you able to live full time on just what you were getting from the podcast hosting, podcast websites business?
Yeah, we were. There was maybe an 18-month transition period, but from day one, Kieran and I were drawing a salary from the wow. podcasting web business.
Entrepreneur on Fire promoting it? Was that, I know John Lee Dumas, mm-hmm. who we're talking about here, his podcast, I mean, it's huge now. I think even then it would probably, and you had the perfect offer for his audience. He was selling podcast coaching mm-hmm. back then, I remember. So that would have given you a flood of new customers, but then what? Like, you have to still keep growing, get new customers, right? So was there a growth plan for that company that allowed you to take a salary so quickly?
So two parts to that. There was a growth plan, but it didn't allow us to take a salary. So there were two disjointed things, and I'll explain what I mean, because it sounds stupid.
Yeah.
So John's audience provided a steady stream of leads, which was fantastic. And, you know, we're still very close with John and Kate, and they run a fantastic business, you know, in what they do. We basically went full bore into embedding ourselves in the podcasting community. You got to remember, back in the day as well, no one was doing WordPress. Like, Blueberry kind of had their sort of plugin. We caused a lot of change in the industry. And I don't mean that to sound like I'm blowing our own trumpets, but we from day one spent our own money on going to Podcast Movement and exhibiting and speaking. I mean, day one, you know, we had no right to be there, but we just went and we did it. We brought design to the podcasting industry. I'm confident in saying that, because we it looked crap, man, before then. Like, everything looked bad. And we said, well, it doesn't have to. And we also went with an open mind, and we helped people, and we did community things, and we did education. And it's easy to think, well, of course you did, that's obvious. But honestly, back then, not a soul was doing it. Not one person was being was serving that audience in the way that we were. So that was the growth plan. That didn't necessarily map to the bigger picture. So remember, at that time, you know, we had a product that served a tiny portion of the addressable market. You know, the podcasting market was still reasonably big. There were new people entering it very, very quickly and very, very readily. But a lot of them had their own website. A lot of them didn't want a website. A lot of them used free plugins. You know, the addressable market for us was tiny. The bit that we were serving was so small. So we set out a 3-year plan, which was to split up the core pieces of Captivate, and also introduce one other piece, which is the interaction tech. Split up the core piece of podcast websites and turn them into specific businesses, so that what we could do, remember I said right at the beginning, you know, the podcast hosting is the thing. Everyone needs a podcast host, every podcaster, but not everyone needs the WordPress part of it. So if we could do something that opened up more of the addressable market, the other stuff would benefit as well, because we had a ready-made funnel and ready-made pipeline. Hence the launch of Captivate. That's what we did. So that was a 3-year repositioning plan. You know, we spent a hell of a lot of time being patient, a lot of time doing the things that, you know, we had to come up against people saying this is the wrong strategy and this is not how you should do it. And we just said, look, this is our plan. We're confident in it. Just give us 2 years, give us 3 years. And sure enough, 3 years in, the plan is fully formed and it's been delivered. So that was the growth strategy. And we knew very early on with the websites business that, and we still do this to this day, that we can serve people really well. Like, we love that business and we love the people that we work with. Like, we genuinely enjoy doing that. But we knew that as long as it paid what we needed to pay, we were no worse off than when we had the agency. So we were able to leave the agency, step away from it, be no worse off, but suddenly have all this time and all of this focus to build these other things. So we were really patient, and we chose specifically, yes, we'll grow the web business and we'll keep it churning, but what we're not going to do is put 40 hours a week into growing it like we probably could have done, because we knew the bigger picture was over here. So that's it was a you know, when I look back at it, I've never really talked about it like that. Like when I look back at it, that was a, it was a pretty gutsy strategy because it could have gone completely wrong.
It's hearing it, obviously, you're giving us a surface level touch on the strategy, but it does sound like you're breaking a fundamental rule where you don't normally try and sell three things at once. You know, you find the one thing that's really popular and you go all in and maximize it as much as you can, and then move on to maybe another thing, a spin one off as a separate entity and so on. But I also can imagine, especially coming from an agency model where in web in particular, with a web agency is, I think, one of the worst business models in some ways, because you do get called upon to do everything. Yeah, you can build my website. Can you set up my podcast? Can you design, you know, every element that goes into some kind of content marketing piece, the social media part of it, maybe the podcast part of it? They sort of look at it as a jack of all trades. And now, of course, the markets have fragmented and become specialized. So yeah, you go to a podcast website design service like you started for that specific part of web design. And then obviously you need hosting. So it's something you would not necessarily expect to get from the same company, but it's comfortable to get it from the same company. And then if that works, you can separate them into two entities. But what I'd like to know, you know, the 3-year block and even bringing us up to the current world where you have all these things running at the same time, how does it look like from a... Because what I struggle with even myself, because I'm an entrepreneur, I want to have this company. I do have, you know, an email services company. I have obviously my podcast. I have my blog. I have a coaching business behind all that. And then there's other things going along. And it's every day it's wake up and, you know, I want to kind of do them all, but I have to stick to maybe the one that's got to generate the money that pays the rent, or it has a goal that I'm most excited about, whatever the case may be. How do you currently control and manage all this? And is there a big team behind all these platforms? Like, do you have a one for Captivate now? Because I know it was just you two at the start. One for podcast websites. You've got, I mean, I don't know how much Rebel-based media is a business of itself still as well. Like, what does the team look like? And are you, like, you the CEO telling everyone in these teams to do different things throughout the day? Like, what's a day in the life of Mark basically at the moment?
Yeah, good question. I'll break that down into sort of the handling the not doing too much when it goes against all of the advice, and then sort of get to the more modern version of the teams and so on, and yes, how we sort of did that. So you're right, completely. You know, we should be focusing on one thing, and we do, and we did. To give some insight into this, the first ever product idea that I had in podcasting in 2014 is the product idea that we are only just pushing out into alpha. In fact, 6 years after we decided to do something with it, almost to the day, yesterday, we got a US patent granted for that very technology. Because of a lesson in patience, in doing the very thing that you'd said, which is what do I need to do right now? So there is one sort of, I suppose, unseen change that was happening in podcasting, which forced us to think a little differently. Podcasting, around the time that we were developing this 3-year plan, suddenly decided that it wanted to be a big media business. And we were already in it. So we had to very specifically, one, move quickly, two, move in a very focused fashion, and three, start to do the things that would lead to results 6 years later. So at the beginning of that 3, 4, 5 year plan, I started filing the patent for this product, and I'd maybe touch it once every month. We got the patent attorney sorted out. We knew when we wanted to hire someone. We knew what the tech would look like. We built the API for it on a weekend, and we parked it. We left it. We didn't touch it for 2 years. And then we did. And then the patent got granted. So we were able to skip over these things, having an eye on where the industry was sort of going to be in a little while. We were very fortunate because we were in podcasting right at that point. We'd been in it for 2 or 3 years. We'd seen where it had been. We saw the precipice. We saw where it was going. And we were able to put those foundational pieces in and then come back to them later.
Do you mind just, Mark, because I feel like you and I are both podcast insiders. And when you say podcasting decided it wanted to be a media business,
what does that mean? I kind of feel like I know what you're talking about, because suddenly everyone had a podcast and Lewis Howes was suddenly famous talking to celebrities. And I was like, Lewis Howes is just a friend of mine from internet marketing. How is he suddenly talking to, he's on the Ellen Show, and all these podcasts were exploding. But something else was happening too, because Gimlet Media, I know, big podcasting company, was formed probably around the time you're talking as well. And that's a different kind of podcast model. So what's your interpretation of that shift?
Yeah. So when we say podcasting as media, you know, we think of podcasting as this sort of industry where independent people can do whatever they want to do. But around 2014, 15, 16-ish, I mean, 2016 is the easiest way to pinpoint it, you know, with the launch of Serial, where it became a media for the masses. So Netflix had educated my mum on the fact that she could get whatever she wanted visually whenever she wanted it. Uber had educated on the same thing for travel and Deliveroo and Just Eat, and Uber Eats had educated on the same thing for restaurants. So suddenly this on-demand audio that was RSS-driven, you had to have a fancy app on your phone, was actually just Netflix for radio. And people started to get into it more, but they started creating IP. They would build shows, intellectual property, with an eye on selling them to movie studios and TV studios. And that, you know, this is an entirely different topic we could get deep into, but that's the fracture beginning to happen in 2016, 2017 that we're seeing much more of now. You know, Q-Code, Wondery, Pineapple Studios, all these people, Macmillan producing these amazing things that are intended to be mass market entertainment media, not Lewis Howes interviewing Gary Vee. You know, that's different, you know? So that's the split that happened. But we were fortunate enough to be at the podcast conferences when one year Apple turned up. What are you doing here? And then suddenly the year after Spotify turned up, and then Amazon showed up, and Wondery, Hernan and the team. But then you're like, what's going on? This was just like 50 people last year. Yeah. And so we were able to, that's the precipice I'm talking about. It was either going to drop or it was going to fly. And it flew, because people start creating this mass media.
Okay. Does that change your business in any way at that time?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. So what that did for us, Yarrow, is it did two specific things. It made us focus on Captivate much earlier. And we got, you know, we built that, and it's a great platform, and it was built really, really well. And we built that, you know, we just thought, right, consumer-based podcast host, we need it, because now my mum's going to want a podcast because her mate's told her that her mate's got a podcast, you know, because everyone's got them. So we needed a consumer host. So we did. We built Captivate. It's brilliant. We love it. But this big podcasting stuff, that original idea, this interaction tech idea, like, that's for the indies like you and I, but it also has big implications and technical implementation opportunities for the bigger tech platforms, the bigger production companies, hence us filing the patent. Yes.
Because you haven't explained what that is yet. I didn't know if you were allowed to talk about that or not.
No, I'm not going to go into too much depth on it, but it's interaction tech, essentially.
Okay. That's where you're
But it has implications for the, I know, right? It's got implications for the bigger companies, which, you know, they can use it. So we kind of started those wheels in motion. That was what it did for our business. We knew, which kind of brings me to the bigger question about how we run it. We knew that number one, I couldn't run everything, that Kieran couldn't run everything. So what we did was, you know, those component pieces of podcast websites, the web platform, the hosting platform, the education platform, we exploded those out into three constituent pieces and registered a company for each one of them. So podcast websites does the management stuff for WordPress. You know, the Academy runs through Rebel Base Media, which is a membership business, and Captivate runs is its own business. Now, what we were very, very focused on was very specifically launch Captivate. Remember, at this point, we have profile in the industry. We shout about it long enough and loud enough, people turn up when we launch, and sure enough, people bought Captivate from day one. And rightly so, it works. It's not just on the strength of shouting. It's a brilliant platform. And we were then able to take that money, because guess what? We got podcast websites. We don't need to draw a salary from Captivate at this early stage. We just keep living on this stuff. We're able to hire in a support team, and suddenly, you know, 18 months, 2 years later, where we are now, Captivate is a team of 12 people, a range of developers, a multinational support team, a range of designers, a marketing team, and the same for podcast websites, a very small team of very focused WordPress individuals that do a great, great job. Productivity, the interaction tech, guess what? It's got a developer, and they just work on productivity. And it was very carefully planned. And, you know, we talked about that focus, you know, that whole do one thing until you've got it to the point where it's not necessarily exhausted, but where it's running well. That's what we did. Podcast website runs itself. Captivate doesn't run itself. I steer it. I guide it. But everyone is really good at their job, and that's why we hired them. So I'm confident that, you know, I can have my COVID vaccine, have a day off because I've got symptoms, and the business doesn't set on fire. Everything works really, really well. And that was the model. That's how we did it. And that's what we still do. You know, we're doing this now with the interaction tech productivity. You know, we've got the one developer, Ed. He and I work on that. And it's a repeatable model. We're just in alpha with that, which is working really well. We've got the patent granted. And it's, you know, off it goes. So that it's been a proven repeatable model. But the key thing to take away from that is that you are absolutely right. Like, you can't do too much too soon. You've got to have confidence in, like we did with the interaction stuff, do one thing that you need to do now to set it up for the future. Pop it on a shelf and come back to it when you can dedicate some time to it. That's been vital to what we've done.
Interesting. So maybe as we kind of head to the last few questions here, Mark, and we're, you know, I feel like we've connected the dots. I have a better feel for what you're in charge of. It's almost like three business units, and you're the CEO of one of them, but you're obviously the founder of all three of them, co-founder. The podcasting, it feels as that we record this, it's almost like a second kind of period of explosive growth as the platforms start to come out, like, you know, new software tools like Riverside, Apple suddenly deciding that we're going to take this as seriously as Spotify is, and we're going to let people monetize with paid subscriptions and things like that. It's all just happening as we record this. It does feel like it's one of those moments in time where there'll be a big boom of lots of different tools exploding, and then it'll start to consolidate. And you could imagine podcast hosts start to merge, you know, podcast recording tools start to get acquired and become under one company. I know you aren't necessarily sure about what direction all this is going, but in terms of your own businesses, is the vision to possibly exit some of them, sell them off? It sounds like you're excited about this patent with a physical tech you're building, which is maybe, I don't know the details, but it sounds like it's physical and software, which is that's always a unique challenge. What is like the vision for your own companies, if you're that clear on it now? I know sometimes myself, I tend to build things as I go and adjust as I go as well, but you must be feeling, okay, you know, Captivate could be the 10-figure business here, because it is in a growing massive marketplace. It's a SaaS, it's a subscription, it's got all those sweet things that people love to hear about. You could even think about taking venture capital and going huge and all those kind of things. Does that all cross your mind?
The venture capital thing doesn't at all. Okay. Remember the control thing, you know?
Yes.
I would struggle like heck with that, mate. And honestly, I don't know if I want that. Like, I set my businesses up when I was 23. You know, I was a bullish 23-year-old. But I always had an eye on being older and being able to take my kid to school, and all I want was just someone to not make me sit on a chair when I didn't want to sit on a chair, and instead be sat on a chair watching my kid play soccer or in a band practice. You know, do all the things that you want to do as a family person. And that's why I do what I do. So venture capital and that sort of thing doesn't interest me, because that comes with inherent pressure. My job is to be the person that looks after those closest to me. That's my job. You know, the businesses are something that I love doing, and my users are the people that I look after the most in that realm. So I think, yeah, you know, there's always an eye on de-risking, you know, because Captivate or any other product that you build, and you'll have, you know, you've been in that position and will continue to, because that's what we do. We keep building things. You know, when you've got something that's growing, inherently you've got risk associated with it. You progress in your own life based on that particular product or the success of that product, and that's where the risk comes in. So there's probably an element of de-risking at some point. I think you're right. You know, Kieran and I spoke about this. Consolidation will happen inevitably. You know, it's already starting. We've seen that. And For me, it's really about doing the thing that I want to do, you know, and really enjoying what I do, making sure I can provide for the family and give them a great life, give the kids the opportunity that I never had and that, you know, we want them to be able to have and let them make their own way, but de-risking some of the business. So I think whilst we don't know what that looks like, you know, there is an opportunity for us potentially to think about that. Would we want to go public? Would we want a VC in the future to get to that point? Probably not, man, because that's a lot of late nights for me. And I'd rather, you know, I'd rather be woken up by a kid that needs me than thinking about what a venture capitalist thinks about my decisions, you know?
Yeah. Okay, well, let's wrap it up with one question. Mark, I didn't tell you this. Maybe you know, maybe you don't know, but I've kind of rebranded this show. I'm calling it Vested Capital going forward. I'd like to kind of tie into that concept, and I know I'm always interested in this. It can be a very personal question, so you can take it as personal as you want to. Looking back on all the things you've done to make money, to build your own capital, and possibly what you're thinking about in the future in terms of growing capital, could you advise everyone listening purely, and maybe if you want to tie it into what's been the biggest source of your capital over the years, like what would you recommend to the audience to focus on if they are focused on growing a really serious, to make a lot of money? I don't, no other way of putting it, but maybe also tied into, you know, the mistakes or the directions that were not a right fit for growing money. Like it does sound like you had an opportunity to make a lot of capital at 23, earning 200 grand a year, but at the end of the day, that still wasn't the right path for you. So take that question or multiple questions, however you like, but you know, what's your advice?
Yeah, I think there are three things that I'd suggest. First and foremost, the old cliche, the old obvious one, which is you've got to really enjoy what you're doing, because no matter how much money comes with it, you know, you're never going to look back at 80, 90 years old and think to yourself, do you know what? I'm glad I had all that money, but lost all that time with the kids or the family, you know, and by enjoying something, you give people the opportunity to be around you as you can be at your very, very best, because you'll have the bad days, but the bad days are not there because you're doing something that you hate. They're there because they're a byproduct of doing something that you love. And you just, in my view, you become just the genuine version of you that you can continue to be regardless of what you do. That's why people who set up multiple businesses keep doing it, because they enjoy different things at different times in their life. So I think really focus on that part of it. I know it's cliched. I know it's very soft, but I do think that's sort of the baseline. The second thing that I'd really focus on is, it's going to sound cliched to start with, but it's tactical when you get to it, which is focus on people. In the early days of a business, all you have is relationships, and you know, all you can do is be very, very good to people, be very, very honest, be very, very transparent, and be very, very helpful. Now, the way that you can tactically scale that is by making sure that when you do build something, that, like we talked about earlier with the support side of things, like that should be the first thing that you focus on, is the experience. Because it's easy to defend your platform. If someone comes in and, you know, we have it, we Captivate, someone's having a bad day, and they kick off, you know, and it's not anything to do with us. It's Apple Podcasts that's down, or you know, their microphone's not working, and that, you know, the one thing that the typo that's in Captivate because they typed it is Captivate's fault. You know, it's not, but that's all right. It's not our job to say, wait a second, that's on you. It's our job to put the arm around and say, you know what, actually, we got your back. I've covered you on that one. Oh, and by the way, let me know what else I can do. I'm really here for you. Like, oh, we have all this stuff. We've got these all these live things that we do where you can just come and be around other people. Like, that is core, and scaling that support is vital. The third thing that I would focus on, and I would really suggest to people, is get good at either marketing or get good at realizing which bits of marketing you're not ever going to be good at, and do that early. Because if you don't, you'll go from zero to one, but you'll top out at one. You're never going to get any further. You know, you'll never get to an eight-figure business. You'll hit out at a low seven, or whatever, you know, whatever your goals are and your aspirations are. Those three things, I think, are things that I wish I'd been told when I was younger, that I'm not even sure the college tutors could have taught me had I stayed on. But I think if you put them at the center of everything that you do, they'll serve you if you're a tradesperson, if you're a digital entrepreneur, they'll serve you if you go get a job, you know? So I think they're absolutely vital.
And is it safe to say in terms of your own financial success, it's mostly been in the podcasting space, like not as a podcaster, but as a support service to podcasters?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, podcasting, absolutely. It's been my career for nearly 10 years now, man, which is insane when I think about it.
Yeah, well, it's a good field to be in. You've been riding a wave, which I feel is just getting bigger at the moment. So I hope it continues to rise and doesn't ever come down and become a nothing. It would make me sad. I listen to podcasts probably more than I read books, that's for sure. And even maybe more than Netflix, which is saying a lot. So,
wow, that is saying a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I probably should track that because, you know, one binge watching session of a series on Netflix can suddenly be 8 hours, and I wouldn't sit there and listen to 8 hours straight of podcasts, you know, or audiobooks. But still, it's definitely some serious time put into both audio and video. Mark, we've mentioned a lot of websites. Obviously, Captivate.fm is the main one we've been mentioning back and forth. Any others you want to send people to now, or just, you know, you want to give them focus? You want to give them lots of options?
We'll give them one thing. This is one of my tutorials that I always give to podcasters. Give them one call to action.
Okay.
And that's always just social. Just get me on Twitter. That's the place that I'm around the most, and it's the place that we can actually have a chat. So I'm just at Mr. Asquith on Twitter anytime.
I think that's how I asked you onto this podcast, to this episode on Twitter. So yeah, it works.
I think it was, actually.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate the time. Good luck with all the tools. I'm looking forward to seeing this new patented secret technology that you've got coming up soon. So that will be fun. It's rare for digital entrepreneurs to get into physical. So that's always exciting to see. And keep up the good work. I appreciate your effort.
Well, thank you, sir, honestly. And thanks for doing what you do and what you have done over the years as well. You have been a genuine inspiration. So thank you, man. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Vested Capital. If you have any friends or family members who might also benefit from hearing this episode, or they're interested in startups, entrepreneurship, investing, making money, generating capital, those sorts of topics, do send them to my podcast. Right now, I'm rejigging all my domain names around this show. So the simplest way to send it to people, or to find it if you're listening to it without subscribing yet, just go to whatever your favorite tool of choice is for listening to podcasts, whether it's Google or Apple, or could be Amazon, could be Stitcher, could be TuneIn. There's so many different players nowadays. Whatever one you're using, if you type in either my name, Yaro, or Vested Capital, you should find my show where you can subscribe and download previous episodes as well. Once I get my domain name sorted out for the show, I'll also have the website address for you. But hey, most of us, like myself, you're probably using an app, so that's the best way to find the show, and also share it with your friends. Just tell them to go look for Yaro inside their favorite podcast app. Okay, that's it for me. Look out for new shows coming soon. I will talk to you on the next episode. Bye-bye.